Denk an den 31. Juli.
Wieso?
Last Call für deine Steuer.
Oh no, ich weiß gar nicht, wo ich anfangen soll.
Weil wieso Steuer? Das ist wie Steuererklärung, nur ohne Stress.
Ist das einfach?
Klar, macht fast alles automatisch.
Dauert das lange?
Nö, einfach per App.
Na dann.
Hol dir jetzt dein Geld zurück mit Wieso Steuer. Bis zum 31. Juli abgeben.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 28, Episode 3. Coming up on the show, we've got the Lost White Tribe of the Outback, a new twist on the Somerton Man mystery, and blacking out in a Men in Black Uber. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
Well, it's not entirely blacking out in the Uber. You are picked up by Men in Black, but you black out afterwards.
Doesn't that always happen in a Men in Black Uber? You always lose consciousness at some point.
Well, most of the time, people aren't getting into the vehicles driven by the Men in Black. Normally, they're just being harassed or intimidated by Men in Black. They're not actually climbing into the vehicles. Well, I have a story of Tatiana, who was this Russian woman who was picked up by Men in Black and taken to meet an entity known as the Cardinal. And that kind of fits in with the theme of the stories I'm going to be covering today. I'm going to be talking about pseudo-vehicles and strange cars that have been encountered with people. I've got this great case coming out of France of a man that allegedly spent a year in an underground base, extraterrestrial base in India.
That's all I heard from you today is complaining that everything's in French.
Oh, it is. It literally everything about this story was in French. And I had to go digging because the premise of the story was so fantastic. And it just so happens that the guy that had this experience, his name was Robert L. And I managed to track down just minute details. And most of it online is gone. It was written originally by Mark Gray. And he's this French university scholar who essentially obviously is fascinated with paranormal topics. And he must have been attending a French paranormal conference. And this is where Robert appeared. And in 2005, described this incredible experience he had. But the problem is, the book that he wrote is in French. So I'm like, well, I've got about 6 hours to learn fluent French, or I could just pull out of the notes of the conference what he described. So that's what I'm going to do.
And you can't use Google Translate because it comes out even worse.
Oh, yeah, it just does not work at all. So, yeah, but we will be going into those sorts of details in a moment. But what have you got coming up later in the show?
Do you remember the Somerton Man mystery? One of Australia's greatest mysteries. Oh, in the top five, easily.
Taman should.
Yeah.
Wasn't there like some phrase that it was in his breast pocket?
Tamil should, yeah. So this guy, it was December 1948, 1st of December in Adelaide here in Australia, and there was some jockeys exercising their horses on the beach in the morning, mm-hmm. and they came across this guy they thought was sleeping or drunk and passed out. Turns out he was dead. And what unraveled after that is one of the greatest mysteries our country has ever seen.
Yeah, I'll link to the original episode where we covered that, but we spoke about the mystery of that case years ago now.
Like they thought he was a spy. There was all this weird stuff with his clothing. And I'll go into the story in more detail later on and give you an update on a new twist, a new breakthrough in this case.
Oh, I did happen to see in the headlines that there was some new, was it a DNA analysis or something that they...
DNA's been done. They got him.
They found out who he is.
They ID'd him.
Oh, okay.
It's going to blow your mind.
Is he an ET?
Why do you have to derail my whole segment? Why do you have to do that?
The reason why I spend
6 days calling witnesses, researching.
That's a lie.
Translating old Hebrew artifacts. And you're like, is he an alien?
That's a lie, isn't it?
Why are you messing up my segment?
It's a lie.
Yeah, it's a lie. He's obviously not an alien, but it's an interesting case because they found DNA evidence and they've ID'd him now. But what this did was I was looking at this and I thought, well, what's some more Australian mysteries I can cover on this show? So I picked up this book that came out in 2021 from Graham Seal. It's Great Australian Mysteries, Spine Tingling Tales of Disappearances. It's not very spine tingling. It's one of those books where his approach was to just pack as many stories in as possible.
But then want to have no argument.
And then there's just not much information. But what I ended up doing was finding some really incredible ones and just doing my own research and fleshing them out. And I came across this very old tale from 1834 of this English, not explorer, but he was working for an English expedition that was going into the heart of the Northern Territory, like deep into the desert.
What, for mining purposes or trade or?
Just scouting for territory and exploring, basically, seeing what's there. Because at the time, no one really knew what was in the centre of Australia. There was speculation that there was a giant lake there that emptied out into South Australia.
That's right, yes. Yeah, I forgot about that. Remember this from school, like when we did the Burke and Wills expedition, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it wasn't until, I think, a few decades later that they came along and did the first kind of trek through the country, so we finally knew what was there. But this guy had a story to tell. He claims that he came to the crest of a hill. This is in the middle of nowhere, like in the middle of the Australian desert, in the middle of the country, after like after 30 days of traveling on foot, digging for water every day through just the harshest, most remote terrain. And he climbs to the top of this hill and he looks down and he sees this oasis. It's like something out of a dream. There's this beautiful waterway with flowing water and there's trees lined up perfectly like it's been planned. And he sees little boats skimming across this waterway. And in the distance, he can see houses with like palm trees around them. And it looks like a community. There's a wall built around this community.
Is it an Aboriginal community? Because I didn't think that they made huts.
They didn't build houses. They didn't build walls, and they certainly didn't have boats along these riverways in the center of the country. He came across, he claims, a lost tribe.
Oh, wow.
And we're going to go into that story coming up later in the show after we unveil the Somerton man's identity.
Okay, I'm looking forward to that. Well, let's jump into it. The reason why I jokingly asked whether or not he was extraterrestrial is because according to Robert L., there are hundreds of thousands of extraterrestrials that are here on planet Earth. They're already here. Now, this is something that obviously a large number of researchers in the field have spoken about for many years. I saw only recently even, was it Mike Barra? Mike Barra is back in the news headlines.
Mars guy.
Yeah, he's the Mars guy. He's back in the news headlines because he was commenting on the Tic Tac UFOs and the fact that, look, these extraterrestrials, they've been here for a long time, a very long time. And what we're seeing is just a continuation of their presence on Earth.
Do you mean hiding underground or wearing human skins and walking amongst us?
I don't think he went that far, but there was a suggestion that they have been underwater for a long time. And that's like the Sanderson kind of stuff where he was describing, you know, people encountering USOs as opposed to UFOs. There's plenty of reports out there that, you know, you and I have covered over the years, Ben, of people that were working for merchant navy vessels and seeing strange craft come exploding out of the water and flying off into the night sky. And these have been reported in official ship's logs. So it's not just like it's an anecdotal report coming from, you know, just a random person. There are plenty of reports that are official of people experiencing these things. Well, coming back to Robert, he experienced this back in the 1960s, and he clearly wasn't interested in paranormal phenomena. He was just a simple 20-year-old farming boy, and he'd been working on his parents' property in the south of France. This is the French guy. This is Robert. And he'd been there for, you know, obviously most of his life and had never seen anything unusual or anything strange. But all of a sudden, and this is what tends to happen with these sorts of stories, over a period of months, all of a sudden, the farm was plagued by these odd balls of light. They appeared in the evening, they surrounded the house, and they seemed to in some way focus on Robert, although they were, I wouldn't say necessarily at the moment intelligently controlled, but they did seem to have that feel that there was something more to them. There was a sentience about these lights. Now, as Robert started, you know, engaging with these lights, obviously, he was trying to, because you're a 20-year-old, you want to understand what these things are. He was trying to do exactly that. He said, there's something very strange about these lights. There was a feeling about them, and he wanted to engage with them. Now, his father, who was out there witnessing with them as well, like his father was the first person or one of the first people to see them, and he would call out to his son. And he would say, Robert, come here, come and see them. And by the time that Robert got to the window or got around the other side of the house, you know, on the multiple occasions that they were being seen, they were gone. That would just vanish. So they were also playing games, which is all just very odd and unusual because if it was a simple natural light phenomenon that was occurring, they wouldn't react to the presence of a person.
Sure.
And they wouldn't just suddenly appear. Like it seems like they were focused in. So as the activity continued to increase and become more outrageous and more wild, Robert essentially said that he started feeling a presence that was connected to these lights. And now he reported this in 2005 at a French ufological conference. He came out with his story. And around the time, he was obviously promoting his book that he had written.
When did all this occur, by the way?
So this was 1966 when the activity of the lights first occurred.
Why did he take so long to come out with his story?
So because those lights ultimately end up becoming connected with a group of aliens. This group of aliens instructed him that he was not to reveal his story for 40 years.
Well,
and that's why it took so long. And of course, I mean, he makes the argument that he says, well, I experienced something that was just so outrageous for the time that if I had reported this, it would have been seen as I was either crazy or that I was a fantasist and making up stories. The thing is, I don't see it being that much of a big difference now, because when there's 40 years later, you've got no way of verifying really anything that took place. But the guy did disappear for a year. And his parents confirmed this. And what he told his parents, though, was that he was going to go overseas or abroad for a year, and he would be so busy and so tied up that he wouldn't have a chance to write home or communicate back to home. And his parents just accepted it.
You got to back up, because we were going from him seeing lights to now he's disappeared for a year. Tell us the sequence of events. How did he get there?
Yeah, so it's quite wild the way that this worked out, because obviously when you're seeing this light activity on your property, you want to engage with it. You want to go and see it. And he was talking to his father about it, because ultimately he and his father saw it at the same time. So they both were seeing the same phenomena. They realized that something was taking place. And Robert wanted to run up and grab one of these balls. He's like, I can hunt one of these things down. I can chase it. I can grab it. And then this thought came through his head. He's like, oh, what if the balls are pure electricity? I'm going to completely get fried like a sardine. Like, he actually said that to his father. His father's like, no, just leave them alone. We won't engage with them. We'll just see what happens. He said, I know, I'll get the Peugeot. So he goes and gets in his car, and he tries to run one of these lights down. And he's barreling down
the
road.
Clever.
Yeah, he's barreling down the road, and this light is kind of obviously evading him. And then the light suddenly turns around and plays this game of chicken and comes flying back towards him. And he does obviously the game of chicken, and he gives up, and he comes off the road, and he gets out of his car trying to look for any damage, and nothing. Like, nothing's happened. But what's happened now is he's engaged the phenomenon. Like, something is now going to take place, because he then claimed that after he had tried to run one of these things down, that he was in his bedroom and one of the lights came through the wall. It actually moved through the wall. So this isn't a natural phenomenon where you've just got some weird luminescence. I mean, even ball lightning, it shouldn't last for that long. And especially with what happened afterwards, you can go, it's not natural, because it opened a doorway in his bedroom. And he said when it opened a doorway in his bedroom, 9 entities walked through. 9 different people walked into the room.
Please be Pleiadians. Please be Pleiadians.
Well, they are. They're not exactly Pleiadians. But
7 foot tall, 10 out of 10 supermodels.
No, they're described as being human. Like, they look human.
Okay.
But they look unusual.
Oh.
And without going into...
Does that mean hideous freaks?
Well, he says, essentially, that he says they're like they're Japanese, except like they've got the same kind of... Not ruddy, but the same kind of color of complexion.
These are the John Keel guys.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Like, this is
long
back in the
fingers,
60s, long fingers.
Ruddy complexion, oriental looking.
The eye features, like, this is what he was saying that they look like, except they were taller. They were taller than orientals. And this is what is so wild about this, because this is precisely the same time, it's around the same time, I'm sorry, that John Keel was describing encounters with the people were having with the orientals. And it becomes very clear once we start to understand what these things are, or at least what Robert comes to understand what these things are, is that they have been on Earth for a very, very long time, and they are watching, they are monitoring humanity's development.
And now there's 9 of them in his bedroom.
But it does have the typical kind of abductee feel to it, because I do a few things. Like, first of all, he said, because I'd come through the walls a few times.
Are they all males?
No, they're male and female. There's both sexes that come through. But he does point out that he said at first there was this feeling where he would look at his window. He felt compelled to look at his window, and it looked like there was a tractor moving through the field. But then when he looked closer, he realized it wasn't a tractor. It was like this light once again, like it was kind of masquerading. So this high strangeness starts picking up around his property. It's obviously freaking out the animals that are on the property.
What happens from this first meeting with the 9 entities?
Well, when the 9 entities come through, at first, they're not directly engaging him. He says, you know, there's things outside that are projecting light. Stuff is passing through the walls. He says one time he notices that he's kind of, it's this intermittent consciousness that he's experiencing while they're in the room. So it does have this feel of like a typical hypnagogic kind of experiences where maybe he's imagining this stuff. But he says ultimately, once he starts to become more conscious as the activity takes more place, he notices that there's this bracelet around his arm. And he looks down at the bracelet and he says it fills up with blood, but he doesn't feel anything. There's no pricking. There's no pain. There's just this weird extraction of his blood.
He's still in his bedroom?
He's still in his bedroom. There's nine entities standing around. You've got this glowing portal, which has come from a ball of light that's in his bedroom. And he's just like, okay, yep, yeah, okay. He's all calm about this. And he said, after I'd had the blood extracted, I slept really well. And the next day I got up and I went back to work. But as the activity and the interactions continued, he ultimately gets introduced to one of the beings that presents itself as the guide. Like, he just calls himself the guide. He's small, and immediately Robert says, are you God? And he's like, no. Are you an angel? He's like, no. We are electromagnetic, but we're also human. And we belong to the human race, much like you, but we are far ahead of you. We are explorers of the stars, and our planet is in a galaxy far, far away from here. And he's like, the French equivalent of cool. Okay, that's so, what do you want? He's like, I'm here to teach you what would look like yoga poses, but it's not yoga poses.
What?
And he's like, okay. So he does. He starts engaging in this yoga practice that the guide had taught him.
Does he come regularly and teach him these moves, or is it just in one session?
No, there's multiple sessions that take place, but the first session, and it's fascinating because it does tie up with what I was only talking about in an episode a couple of episodes ago, because what Robert was experiencing right before all this phenomenon started taking place was these persistent, terrible migraines. Mm. He was having these horrible, terrible migraines that were just becoming so bad for him that he wasn't able to work in the field. Like, he'd be out there shoveling hay and all of a sudden he'd be overwhelmed with the nausea and the pain of these migraines. And so these yoga, not yoga poses that he was taught made him recover. And the guide told him that, well, look, you're actually in excellent health, but you have an alignment problem. And by doing these poses and these sessions, you'll be able to, recover from this. And so he's like, oh, okay. So for multiple nights, it's like 10:30 at night, he's there doing these sessions, these yogic moves, and his body is getting better and he's not having migraines anymore and he's having these great interactions with these beings. And as I'm reading this, I'm like, they always want something. Like, there's something around here. Like, why are they just showing up and giving him these poses? I know they're extracting blood from him, but what's the purpose of extracting blood and why teach him these poses? And it just so happens that the guide once again comes through the wall and speaks to him. And says, and this is, by the way, in the first week of January, or roughly the first week of January in 1969. So this had been going on for a couple of years by this point, where the guide says to him, look, you can't continue your work here and your yoga practices, but if you come with me to our underground facility, you can continue your work there.
Because you can't do yoga at home. You've got to go to an underground facility.
How does these weird yoga poses become his work of some kind? Like, it's got this kind of weird spiritual element attached to it.
It's the story that I did on the Last Plus episode of the woman that started breakdancing after she went to a meditation retreat.
Exactly that. Yeah.
She learns these weird moves spontaneously.
Yeah, he's doing these weird moves. And in the meantime, right, as he's been doing these moves, the activity around the farm has changed, because not only is it these balls of light that are flying around, you've also got these weird bullet-shaped cones of light that were appearing.
Yeah.
And as they would drop down, the balls of light would come flying out of them, run around as if they were looking for something, and then would disappear back into the bullet, and the bullet would disappear.
And the father, at any point, does he burst into his son's room and go,
no!
Are you winning, son? And he just sees him in this weird yoga pose with an alien dude. Does that happen at any point? Like, what's the father and the mother doing?
There's this odd feeling about this, that maybe his parents have been incapacitated or, I don't know, because as it's happening late at night, well, relatively late at night. Maybe the parents, because they're farmers, you know, they've gone to bed early and they don't know that their son's doing weird yoga poses with some alien dude in the middle of the night in his bedroom. So who knows? But ultimately, there's some fear that comes from Robert, because he's like, oh, you want me to go to an underground facility? And the guide's like, yes, you need to come with us. If you would like to come with us, all you have to do is come down to this cherry tree, which is at the bottom of the field on the farm.
Once you get there, you will be given a sign not to go any further. You'll have to wait for the column of yellow light, and then you can go forward. And Robert thinks about it, and he's like, he's like, wee, and says, yes, he wants to go.
What did he tell his parents? That he was just suddenly going overseas.
But this is the thing. He tells his parents, and his father's like, okay, great, see you later. But his mother was like, oh, you're going abroad for a year and you won't, like, you're going to be so busy, you won't be able to contact me. He's like, that's right, Mum. That's what I'm doing. And the mother's like, okay, see ya. And he does. He wanders out late one night.
I guess he's in his early 20s.
He's in his 20s. Do what he wants. It's the late 60s. It's all kind of consistent with, you know, what someone in that age probably would have done back then. You're going off to find himself. So what he does is he's like, don't worry. He's told by the guy, don't bring any clothes. You don't need to pack anything. We'll provide everything for you. You know, you'll be fine. He's like, okay. So he wanders out and he wanders down into this field. And as he wanders down into this field, he comes to this cherry tree and he waits at the cherry tree. And as he's waiting, he says, all of a sudden, I see the sky opening up. And as the sky opens up, I see this big circle. It looks like there was another sky in the interior. This spacecraft pushes through and then the sky closes up again. It descends quickly and it's this big circle. It lands about 200 feet away. Now, as it lands, he says this yellow light pillar kind of appears before him and he's able to pass through it. I don't know if it's a cleansing or whatever, but he passes through the light and he walks over to the UFO. And as he gets closer to the UFO, he says he can see it kind of sitting there. And it looks like it's landed, but it's actually hovering. It's just hovering above the ground. The light seems to be causing the anti-gravitic effect as it's there. And there's beings that are waiting. And he looks closer and he sees this tall man. And he realizes that this tall man is the guide that he's seen before. Now, he takes a couple of steps up into the ship and he finds himself inside this very comfortable kind of space. He said he was quite surprised because they had this chair like this. It was kind of in the center and he sat into it. And it was like the most comfortable chair he's ever experienced. I'm like,
oh, dude, alien furniture is the best.
You're climbing aboard a UFO. You're at this French conference in 2005 describing getting aboard a UFO. And you're like, oh, it's a chair. It was so comfortable. And I'm like, okay.
But that is an interesting detail. Like a lot of the contact cases from this time period, they do talk about the furniture molding around their body, that it looks like plastic, but it's soft, or it looks like metal, but it's really soft and comfortable. There's lots of interesting details from that era.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the same stuff that he's describing. And you're right, you know, he describes this detail of the chair. He says, look, it's the typical kind of thing. There's panels around that he can see, but it's all a very smooth surface on the inside of this craft. And he's placed towards the center of the vehicle. And as he's there, he's like, oh, are we going? And the guy turns to him and says, we've already left. And he kind of like wipes his hand or kind of like just kind of, you know, like you're showing something. And this panel appears and everything becomes transparent. And when it becomes transparent, he can see everything. And he says he can see below them. He can see the city. He thinks it's the city of Marseille, but he's not entirely sure. And this voyage takes about 50 minutes to an hour as he's sitting there. Now he comes to this mountainous range. He can see this mountainous range because everything around him is now clear. And as it's flying towards this mountain, all of a sudden the craft just dips down and nosedives into this kind of what, it's difficult to see it, but there's this opening in the bottom of the mountain. It's not like a door opens or anything, but it's kind of a
cavern
cliff
or a
face
cave.
That's kind of, yeah, exactly, obfuscated. And he flies down into this thing and they go back up what appears to be some type of runway and they come out into this large open space. It's this cavernous kind of space. And he's looking around because there is modern machinery everywhere. It's like an underground city of some kind. And the craft lands and he's just in shock. Like he's absolutely in shock. He's taken to his quarters. He's just come to an underground city in the Himalayas in India. And they're like, okay, well, you can go to bed and we'll speak to you in the morning.
It's like, I'm a little pumped.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can sleep right now.
He does. He climbs into bed and he falls asleep. And when he wakes up in the morning, there's these people, obviously, that are servicing him. And they come in and they give him this cup of coffee. Now, he drinks the cup of coffee and he's shocked because the cup of coffee tastes exactly the same way that his mother would make it.
Mm.
It's like, oh my God, like it's at home. It's like, my mother has made it. And he kind of just gets this smile and this nod. Now, his day starts off where he's told, well, we have to get to work. we have to start teaching you more yoga poses. And he's like, I had no idea what I was supposed to do. I had no idea what I was doing. But they said that this yoga pose counts towards his work, and you'll have to work while you're here. And when you're old enough to retire, you'll realize that you've been given a magnificent treasure. And he even said when he was at this conference, he's like, it's only now, 40 years later, that I'm beginning to understand this treasure that I was given.
Is there any other human beings like us in this base?
Not that he describes. There's plenty of human beings that are there, but not human beings as in earthlings. They're all foreign.
These other entities are just filling the place. How many is there? Is it like it's huge. It is really like a city?
There's thousands of them. Like there's so many of them. He doesn't go into great detail describing
what are they
exactly
wearing?
How many there are. It's typical of like a one-piece kind of suit.
Oh, yes.
Which we hear in many abduction tales.
All looking the same.
it's all kind of strange. But this is where, you know, it does fit in with traditional abductee, more so contactee kind of stories, because obviously he's got questions. Like he wants to know, why am I here? Why have you taken me for a year to this underground base? What am I supposed to do? And they start saying to him, well, the reason why we took the blood is because you have something special genetically and we need that information.
Right, there you go.
There you go. And guess what they're using him for? He needs to repopulate other planets that have been decimated, and they're using his DNA as the scaffolding to repopulate these other locations.
Are they just using his DNA?
Well,
if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a good
question.
Getting
feelings of Planet Gok Adventures here.
There is a depiction, actually.
His mission is to go and seed the new race on all these different sex planets.
Where was I? I don't know if it's in my notes here. Let me just have a look.
Oh, it's in the notes.
No, there was a depiction, right? So essentially, he's got the guide, but he's also introduced to two good-looking women. And one of them is known as the biologist, and the other one is known as the ethnographer.
That's
and
hot.
There is, I can't remember, I must have read
it's like
it somewhere
a nurse
else.
Fantasy, but it's a biologist and an ethnographer.
Well, there is this point where it doesn't go into too much greater detail, and I can't
find. Is there a librarian as well?
No.
Hot.
Well, yeah, well, look, he's French. Where's the French maid outfit?
Yeah, French maid, of course.
Come on.
Obvious.
But there is a depiction later on of where there is a, every 2 days, he has his semen extracted.
Oh, he does. Okay, there you
he
go.
He does. Yeah, so there it does go. Fit in with the hybrid kind of
and
program.
And how... per se, does this extraction happen?
It's not described. It's like one of the women walks into his room and a device is utilized.
Oh.
And then that's it. Like there's no other information about it. And this is a problem, right? Because I can't read his book.
It's
in French.
All the good stuff is in French.
I can't get the exact details. I've had to pull this out from multiple posts, some of which have been removed. And I managed just to find, you know, some of the fleeting details from not only 2005, but 2012, where he attended a conference as well. Now, this is where it's kind of strange. And I feel like the whole thing is strange, but I feel like that he's been subjected to some type of show. It's like maybe back in the 60s, before extraterrestrials thought about the hybrid program and, like, let's just abduct people from their bedrooms and just go with it, that they had some weird kind of, like, let's abduct them and tell them how wonderful they are and how they're going to populate the rest of the universe and, you know, how great they are. Because he says at one point when he's working with the guide, like, here he is, you know, one day, he's in his room, he's doing all these yoga poses, and the guide walks in. And the guide is like, oh, I have to go. And he says, why? Why do you have to go? He's like, oh, I have to go to this intergalactic meeting. He's like, oh, can I come? And apparently the two women, like the biologist and the ethnographer, are kind of like look at each other like, well, no, he shouldn't come. And the guide's like, look, as long as you don't say anything and you're quiet, you can come. And he's like, okay, I'll come. So he does. He goes along with them into this large room. And it's like the village people, because all these people start walking in. And what he describes is like they're wearing every different type of like ethnic dress you can imagine. There's like an Indian and there's Asian people and there's just normal clothing.
And they're all wearing their traditional
garb. Their traditional garb, and they sit around this big table. And when they sit around this big table, there's like people on the outside as well. And above them, this massive cloud kind of appears. And this cloud is like a holographic projection. And inside it, you can see the makeup, the nature of the universe. And he's kind of shocked because he says they're all conversing and talking about, it's like this project management meeting for the universe, because they're all kind of controlling everything. But he's like, they're not saying anything. Like they're not talking. And he realizes, he claims that they're telepathically, rapidly communicating with each other for the management of whatever's going on in the universe. And this is where, when he leaves this meeting and asks the guide about what was that, the guide is more forthcoming with all the information about what else is going on. And this is where he says, we've been on Earth for a long time. We're here to monitor Earth 24/7. You are going to try to go into space. The Americans and the Russians will try to go into space. You will try to make bases on the moon. We are going to stop you. Because as you are going into space, you are too violent. The aggression that you take with you is preventing us from allowing you to travel out further into the universe. That's why we're coming and selecting people that we need for our genetic, you know, reservoirs, and then we're going to stop everyone else. And he says, look, it is strange that after this had happened and after he'd had this experience, that the space programs essentially did start to die down, like, quite rapidly.
What he should have done is gone, and just stepped up to the microphone and gone,
Je vais peupler vos mondes d'origine avec mon sperme.
What, does that stop taking my sperm?
I will populate your home worlds with my sperm. Kind of killed it that it was in a female voice, though.
So, yes, I mean, that would have been probably far more effective, but he finds out more information. And this is weird, though, because they make all these outrageous claims. There are multiple bases all across Earth. They're working with the military. The military is very well aware of what is going on. I'm like, well, why, if the military is aware of it, why are they? It just doesn't make any sense to me. He's also told that the shutting down of the, you know, obviously the concern about nuclear weapons, they're trying to stop nuclear weapons. And he's like, you don't have to worry about a Cold War, because if there's a Cold War, we will intervene and we will shut down all the weapons. And I wonder, like, I think about those reports of UFOs being seen around nuclear test launches, Minutemen silos, that kind of stuff, firing laser beams into them, disabling them. I'm like, is this guy just taking, you know, creating this massive story and kind of linking in different elements of UFO phenomenon? Or is it that, like, he really was told this back then? And this is what they are doing. These ETs that are human, superior humans apparently, are trying to prevent humanity essentially destroying itself. It's like they're keeping us in this maintenance until we finally overcome whatever aggressions we have. And that's where the yoga poses apparently come in. I don't know
Point of the yoga poses?
It's like all about, it's not raising your vibrations, but it is that kind of stuff. There's this spiritual element, which is not really described as he's, you know, talking about it in these conferences. But, you know, he's told that he has these certain genetic characteristics that are necessary for repopulating decimated worlds. And obviously he's getting this ego boost that's coming through as he's being told this. But then there's all these other kind of elements that come through. So he's obviously starting to understand more details about this base. And he finds that there's these magnetic band nuclear generators. There's three of them that are downstairs. And he's told, look, you can go anywhere in the base that you like, but you can't go into these rooms. And he's finally like, oh, and because obviously he's like trying to see the entire base. He tries to sneak into one of these rooms. And he claims that when he tries to sneak into one of these rooms, he's immediately hit by this, not only a force field, but it's a wall that is invisible and literally pushes him back and out of the room. It's like this automated kind of thing, which is shocking for him to experience. And the guide kind of just laughs at him of like, well, you know, you can't get near our technology. But the guide's also like, okay, let me show you something. And the whole time this guide has been walking around with like this little orb, like this glowing little orb kind of thing. And he takes him upstairs, like they climb in this elevator and they go all the way up into the top of the Himalayas and it's cold and it's freezing outside and they walk outside. He's like, let me show you this. And he kind of rubs this orb thing. And as he rubs it, it fires this beam out and dematerializes a tree. It's just like,
cool.
Just gone.
It's a weapon.
It's a weapon. Yeah, he's showing them their weapons technology. So while they're peaceful and while they're here to help maintain humanity and improve us, they still have defensive weaponry. And he kind of starts, you know, skiting about the UFOs because he says, look, with the UFOs, there's nothing that you can do. Like, you can't, with our technology, you can't bring them down. And it just so happens, and this is where all of this could be an outrageous story, aside from the fact that when he spoke about this, and I don't know if it was the 2005 conference or the 2012 conference, but he describes this scene of where he takes a excursion. One day, the two women and the guide say to him, we're going to go to France to go and conduct an expedition or an excursion. Would you like to come with us? And he says, oh, of course, yeah, I'll come with you. So he climbs aboard this UFO. When they climb aboard the UFO, it shoots off. It takes about an hour and it arrives over France. Now, once again, the entire exterior of the craft is transparent. So he can see everything that's going on. And they kind of laugh and they kind of have this arrogance about them where they say, oh, well, look at this. And there's this light just suddenly screaming towards the UFO. And they realize it's this French Air Force fighter jet that's coming straight towards them. And The UFO is just playing cat and mouse with it. It's able to duck up and down and around it. He's watching now as he's inside. This is Robert, and he's inside the UFO. This panel comes up in front of him. And when the panel comes up in front of him, it's like a zoomed in view of what's going on in the cockpit. And he can actually see the pilot, like the pilot's face directly.
Right.
And this pilot's kind of freaked out with what he's seeing. He's trying to understand what he's seeing, but obviously very determined. And he can see the pilot kind of spinning his head around and turning his head because he's shocked at the maneuverability and the way that this UFO can move around. And finally, the UFO outpaces it and it's gone. Now, according to the report, people that were at this conference looked up the details of fighter jets that had been scrambled and had engaged unknown aircraft back in this time. There is a report of a French aircraft, a French jet being scrambled to engage with an unidentified craft.
And it matches.
It matches.
Yeah.
So I'm like, well, I mean, if this guy is telling a story, he's obviously gone to a great deal of, you know, effort to find these sources so that he can match up this kind of stuff. And yet somehow he's, you know, got this information. So
you would think he would have a lot of material, though, if he's in an alien base for a year.
Absolutely, you would. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there is, and like I said, I might have missed it because it's in the book. And it's in French. And
why has no one translated this? It seems like this guy's popped up out of nowhere. If he has such a compelling story, why hasn't it been translated into English?
I don't know. But it gets even better, right? Because the book wasn't written by him.
Huh?
The book allegedly was written by the ETs. So he claims...
Come on.
He claims that years later, because he was told, as I explained earlier, that, look, you can't talk about this for 40 years. Like, we want you to spread the word. You must spread the word about what's going on, but you have to hold it off for 40 years before you reveal this. And he's like, oh, okay. But he says that he was sitting at his computer and he's not very good at using Word, the processor, and he says he doesn't know what to do. He kind of zones out and he starts typing. He's not even knowing when he's typing. He's just like going off like a hyperactive typist.
Yeah, yeah.
And by the time that he stops, he's like, oh, I've written the entire story. And the story wasn't written by him. It seemingly was written by the extraterrestrials.
Channeled,
but in French as
by
well.
By Oriental ETs that live under the mountains in the Himalayas.
Yeah.
Taught him yoga for a year.
But he returns home. Like, he returns home.
At any point, does one of the women burst in and go, what's his name? Robert, we've got an emergency. The Repopulator 4000 has broken down. We need to get you to planet Amazonia stat and you need to manually repopulate the entire planet.
Maybe that's in the book. That would make it a much better story if that was in the book, but I don't know. But he does return home. And when he returns home, he's a completely changed man. Look, he spent an entire year away in an underground extraterrestrial / human base. And
now he's got some sweet yoga moves.
He gets in the UFO. He does have some sweet yoga moves, which does play a role later on, right? Because it allows him to project out of his body.
Ew.
So he returns home. And when he returns home, the UFO lands and he climbs out of the UFO and they're like, au revoir, and off it flies. And he starts walking up towards the house. It's late at night and his father's standing there. His father's right there. He's like, oh, Dad, what are you doing? And he's like, oh, I got your letter that you're coming home. And he's like, I didn't send a letter that I was coming home. And he's like, look, and he shows him this letter that was written in his handwriting, but it wasn't him that he was coming home. Now he goes, and his father, though, knew that something else had happened. And it's kind of implied, it's not said directly, that his father knew something was happening in connection to the balls of light and whatever activity was going on, but he didn't really question him about it. He's like, look, you've been somewhere for a year, you know, all good. But then his mother was like, oh, I'm so glad you're home. And how was Sweden? And how was overseas? Like, oh, yeah, good.
Show me all your photos.
Yeah. Now, he has this yellow envelope that he was given by the extraterrestrials, right? And he's like, he opens up the yellow envelope. And because the guide had said to him, look, you will need this because this is for your work. And he's like, for my work? And when he opens it, there's $5,000 worth of francs in there, which was a lot of money back then, right?
Yeah.
He's like, I've just spent a year away and I got $5,000 for doing, that's pretty good. Like, he was happy about this. And then though, everything changed because he started, obviously he had these practices. It seems like these practices had done something to change because he described, first of all, what happened is in France at the time, you would have like this succession plan that would happen with the farmers and you would hand the farm down to the next generation. Now he gets home after being away for a year and finding himself in these yoga poses. And his father's like, okay, I'm ready to hand the farm down to you. He's like, no, I don't want that. No, I don't want the farm. I don't want to take up this life. And his father was obviously immensely disappointed.
Yeah.
But he goes off the rails. Like, he describes being like, it sounds like it's a positive thing, But he basically just becomes a kind of a dropout. Like he doesn't really do anything. Like he wants
Seems
to go
like
and
the familiar trend isn't with it? These people that are chosen.
It's so familiar about how this happens. Like it's the same kind of thing. So at the same time though, he never felt homesick because when he was back at the base, he mentioned that he wanted to know what his parents were talking about. So the aliens one day bring in this massive eye. Like it's a device that looks like an eye. And they put it on a stand in the corner of the room and he walks over to it. It's got three buttons on the front. He's like, oh, I don't want to touch the buttons. But whenever his parents are having an argument or talking, the eye opens up and then it displays his parents and he was able to see everything. So he knew exactly what was going on at home.
Kind of an invasion of privacy.
Oh, I think so. I think absolutely it is. But skip forward, right? So it was about 1 or 2 years.
Why would he
need
to know what his parents are arguing about?
I don't know. I don't know what. So this is the thing. I think it's all been done to deliberately confuse and make things difficult. And because I don't think that what they're telling him is the truth. Like, because it fits in with the rest of the contactee kind of phenomenon where there's all this big kind of, you know, fancy stuff that's made about it. But it's like the whole time, dude, they're just milking you every couple of days.
Yeah, they're just repopulate. They're just using your batter to power the repopulator 4,000.
I mean, it sounds like a lot of effort to go through. But anyway, you know, so they've done this. So skip forward 1 or 2 years after his return from India. And he says he was at this local festival and there was this guy there that he didn't know too well, but he had this Citroen DS. It was like this French luxury car, he said. And this friend of his, this acquaintance, says, look, there's this really awesome nightclub that's in the next town over and I think we should go. And he's like, yeah, okay, that's really cool. Let's go. So they go to this nightclub and they go dancing, but they didn't drink alcohol. And he said it was a really cool night. And it was about 1 o'clock in the morning when they got into the car, right? And they're driving back. And this guy knows nothing about Robert's sojourn into, you know, this underground facility. Like, obviously, you don't go and talk about it because he can't for 40 years. And as they're driving along in this car, suddenly the car comes to an abrupt screeching halt. And the guy like smacks his head on the steering wheel because that's how rapidly they stopped. There's this weird smell that permeates through the car and the car's vibrating and Robert's going, what's going on? And then the friend is like, I don't know what's happening. I don't know what's happening. And everything stops. Everything just stops and everything's quiet. And there's like a fog kind of around them. And they get out of the vehicle, and when they get out of the vehicle, they wander over and they realize that they were about to drive into a gulch or a drop that was about 100 feet, and the car had stopped just about a yard away.
Is he being protected?
He's being protected.
They're protecting their investment.
Yeah, the ETs seemingly are protecting him.
They need to get this story out in 40 years.
That's right.
It's going to change the world.
So he's, obviously this acquaintance is all freaked out, and the acquaintance is like, I never want to see you again. I don't want to have anything to do with you. And that's it. Like this, he's really freaked out, which makes me wonder if he'd seen or experienced something else, which is not revealed, but perhaps it's revealed in the text. But then he realizes that with these abilities, see, he becomes obsessed with death. And you know what he does? He goes from having, you know, succeeding to having the farm, right? He's like, I don't want the farm anymore, to getting involved in an old folks home, working as an orderly and becoming obsessed with dead people. Like he's obsessed with the dead. And he's like, oh, I like being around dead people because when I was in the underground base, they essentially describe how they're immortal. Like there's no, the body is a shell. And through their yoga practices, which they had somehow imbued into a device, they could take a device and they could place a device in someone and essentially transfer out their consciousness from one body and into the next. Mm. And he could see it. Like he could see like the out of body kind of event taking place. And he felt like when he was now obsessed with death and working in this old folks home, that he was somehow helping people pass on. Like they were, he would see them climb out of their bodies.
Did he just go and do the downward dog next to a dead body?
And like it's, well, we just did that episode on Kundalini, right? And one of the things that is described by people doing certain yogic practices, and I'm not just talking about the run of the mill kind of, you know, you're doing your yoga, you know, in a studio somewhere. This is long, hardcore practices that in some circumstances can convey supernormal abilities and people can see things and have, and this is kind of what I feel like's happened with this guy. He's been trained with all these odd yogic poses and it's allowing him to see things that normally we can't see. But the obsession with it, it's like, I don't understand. Why would you become obsessed with death and helping people move on? It's so strange. But he later on describes that he also realizes that he can project himself out of his body and influence people using these poses. So he claims that when he was trying to understand how he could control things, he finds himself in a car park in this French supermarket, and he sees this woman that he doesn't know entirely too well, but he's an acquaintance of hers. And he sees what she's doing walking through. And he's like, maybe I can control her. Like, maybe I can do it. So he's standing behind this vehicle where this woman's friend was sitting in the car. So he can hear the conversation that occurs later on. But what he does is he uses his powers that he's acquired to essentially project himself like a thought. He says, essentially what you do is you create an image of yourself and then you project the thought into the image. So it's kind of like the description of creating a topic form in a way.
Yeah.
But you project that thought into the image and then you can use it to control people. And so what he does with this woman who's in the supermarket, he's like, okay, now it's time to leave the supermarket. And all of a sudden she's like, oh, I have to leave the supermarket. So she wanders out. And as she wanders out of the supermarket, he's like, okay, stop. And she stops in the middle of the road. He's like, now go back into the supermarket. He's like, oh, I've forgotten something. I must go back into the supermarket. Almost in this Jedi mind trick kind of experience where she wanders back into the supermarket. Meanwhile, the friend who's sitting in the car is watching this. She can see into the supermarket. She's like, what is she doing?
Yeah.
Why is she walking? And she does. Finally, he controls her and returns to his body. And he watches as this woman kind of wanders over and she's completely zombified. Like she's out of it. And the friend says, what are you doing? What's going on?
This is a great ability. This is definitely going to help humankind.
Yeah. I'm like, what is it doing apart from just messing with people? And the friend starts questioning her. She's like, what is wrong with you? You're in this zombie-like daze. She's like, I don't know. I just blanked out for a second. And it's like, well, no, she hadn't blanked out. She seemingly had been under the control of Robert and his extrasensory capabilities. So you have to question, well, what's the point of all this? You know, like going through these incredible experiences and it takes him 40 years to describe, you know, what had happened. Ultimately, we come down to the conclusion that, well, look, they're still here. They're still around. He doesn't describe whether or not he's still interacting with them, but he does have these incredible abilities. And finally, you know, he does things like he starts teaching other people his abilities and he does crazy things like helping people to project themselves out of their body so that they can sit on their own lap. I'm like, okay, like that's great that you might be able to do that, but you know, it's not a huge benefit to humanity really, is it? You know, why is this going on? Now, ultimately for me, I feel like what's happened to this guy is that he was one of the early abductees. Like he does have contactee kind of feelings about this, but it feels like it's an abductee kind of stuff. And the fact that they took him to this underground base makes me think that it was a way to contain him for a long time to be able to do what they could. But in the end, they point out to him that he is one of 300,000 people on the planet that have been contacted and are directly monitored and part of this odd yoga spiritual program.
So there's all these sleeper cells of weird yoga practitioners embedded in society ready to be activated.
But for what?
To control everyone.
And that's the thing, is that they are controlling our nuclear weapons and they are controlling the level of aggression. And it also answers other things because it says, oh, well, you know, like what about World War II? And they're like, well, we'll allow certain things to take place. Like we will not steer humanity in any general direction. We just will let humanity do what it can do. But if humanity goes too far, then we will step in. And I'm like, again, it doesn't sound like this is for the benefit of humanity. It sounds like it's for the benefit of the ETs and whatever they're doing and how they're masquerading. Like they're carrying on that again, they're highly advanced humans.
They're extracting his sperm and
yeah.
It's extracting his blood.
It doesn't feel right. So
it's a shame you couldn't get it in English because it sounds like there's a lot more in there.
Yeah,
it's got a lot more.
I couldn't even get the
share title.
I couldn't even get the title of the book.
Is there actually a book?
No, there's a book. There's definitely a book because he describes it in the 2012 conference where he's describing, you know, all this incredible phenomenon. He has this Q&A because he returns to the French ufological conference. And that's where he had been interviewed by one of these ufological researchers. And also he was presenting in a Q&A describing all these details.
How do you know there's a book if you can't find the title even in French?
He did the book. He described it. He's like, I wrote the book. And as I said, he didn't write the book. He wrote the
channeled
book
it. Yeah, channeled, whatever.
Yeah.
Surely you'll be able to find it somewhere.
I cannot find it. I cannot find any more detail. And unfortunately, because I only have, and this is the weird thing, I've only got the first letter of his surname. So I don't even have his full name to find it. And when I found the article, right, and you'll find this, when I found the article, the our only piece that's like broken up into four or five pieces, only the first piece exists online anymore.
Is there a video of this guy at this conference?
No.
What conference is it?
It was the Marseille conference that happened.
So it's possible that this guy doesn't even exist.
It's possible, but...
like, I could make a story about some UFO contactee in Belgium and say he's written a book and I interviewed him.
Possibly.
And then just give you his initials. Well,
this
and
is the problem.
Like, there is no guy in Belgium.
Well, like I said, this was written by Marc Gray, who is the French paranormal researcher. But the issue is, because it is French, and I don't speak French, I have no way of trying to, you know, go through and find information about this to connect the dots or find out what's going on.
I just looked up Marc Gray. It says Marc Gray is a fictional UFO researcher.
That is not true.
Created by a rogue online prank group.
That is not true. There is a group, right, where Marc Gray is connected with the LePazUFOLOGIQUE.com group, but I can't find any actual details. Again, it's all in French. Protest, nos excuses, mans ancien, resultant, non ton trove. My French
is
terrible.
What the fuck is this? Is this... French?
I do not know French at all. I don't even know pronunciations in French. All I know is Versailles and Marseille, and that's it. So.
Well, it is a new one. Add it to the pile of contactee, abductee cases we've had over the years.
Yeah.
What's that, about 3,000 now?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's strange how when you look at these stories, while they all have this kind of different set of attributes to them, you always find this core kind of common theme about it, which suggests to me that it's not different groups of extraterrestrials. I think this is all the same entity masquerading in different ways. Although in saying that, when you look into stories of underground ET bases, some of the most well-known ones, obviously, are things like Dulce, right? Where they're describing interactions of the military working with the Greys and people, you know, fighting the Greys underground. But the most common entities that come up in reports are the reptilians. Like, the reptilians seem to come up in a multitude of alleged underground bases and reports that come through. And, you know, just to finish this section, I'll just link you to a little article that was published by Paul Dale Roberts. And Paul Dale Roberts, because I was thinking about this connection to the military and possibly the military working with extraterrestrials and underground bases, and he describes this story of two soldiers that had gone looking for the lost Dutchman's mine in the Superstition Mountains. This is in Arizona. They were from a local fort that wasn't, you know, too far away from the location where they were up in the mountains. And when they'd gone up one evening, apparently they had given up on looking for this mine. You know, there's this story connected with there being a great treasure trove that's up there. But I always wonder about that kind of stuff. Does it fit in with, you know, other elements within the genre? But he claims that these two soldiers were like, oh, they'd taken bottle rockets up with them. So they're like, oh, let's play with bottle rockets. So they start firing bottle rockets at each other and they're having fun and laughing and joking and what's going on. When one of them all of a sudden just starts screaming, like he's screaming. And as he screams, he comes running down and his friend's like, what's wrong? And he says that there was this blue light that kind of like in this humanoid shape that descended from the ridge and started moving towards the soldier. And the soldier was freaked out by it. Now, in the scuffle and them looking around for, you know, trying to see if they could see anything, apparently the soldiers got separated. And the second soldier, who was like, oh, come on, you know, like a blue being and this light that's coming down, what's going on here? When he says that all of a sudden he gets this terrible cut, he feels this cut on his ankle, and he looks down and he says, it's not an animal. It's some type of metallic rolling device with metal teeth that has clamped onto his ankle and is trying to bite him.
It's like one of those things, the chomps from Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah,
right?
That's exactly what it's like. That's exactly what it's like.
Is
it's
it
like,
on a chain?
And he kicks this thing off and the thing just rolls away and disappears into the mountain. It's like it's some type of very rudimentary, but obviously advanced at the same time, defensive device that was there. And they both get back to the base, you know, describing this incredible thing where not only did they see this odd blue light, they also saw some type of weird metallic ball with teeth that tried to chomp into them. So crazy stuff. Like,
I like how you've paired these two stories together. They have equal value.
The story goes is that that particular location where they were, it's not anything to do with the mine. Some people have speculated that there's a reptilian style base there. because you'll find that there's a multitude of reports of people talking about encounters with the Superstition Mountains, where there's been ufological activity, people claiming that they've seen reptilians. There's a report actually from a woman by the name of Carla, who described her sister's experience, Angie, who she, and I'll link to this in the show notes, and I might go through it in the Plus extension, or we might talk about it on another Plus show, where she describes a truly horrific abduction experience from the Superstition Mountains by massive reptilians, like these massive, overly muscular, scale.
Overly muscular.
It's crazy the way she describes them, because it's almost like when they're
Chad-tillians.
Oh, they take their clothes off. Like, so it's got that, it's got a bit of like that paranormal romance kind of genre thrown in there as well. But she has an incredibly horrible experience. Like, it's horrible.
We know what happens.
In the Superstition Mountains, right where this weird ball that was chomping on soldiers was also located. Right. So there's that kind of weird connection there. But look, I'll link to as much of this as I can in the show notes. Look, if you can find a way to find more details out of it, I would love to hear it. I'll also link to that post where you might be able to use Wayback Machine to find possibly something of this French report, and we can see if we can find out exactly who Robert is and what his true experience and his book, like what his book is.
Someone offered to translate all the French stuff for us, but I couldn't understand her email because half of it was in French. I think that's what she was saying, so she wanted to translate stuff for us that's in French.
See, it's a vicious loop. French is a very deceptive language. It's a very difficult, vicious loop to get yourself in.
Do you want an update to the biggest mystery in Australia's history?
Yeah, tell me about
the Somerton Man, the Tummel Should case, the unknown man from Adelaide.
Wasn't it the Tummel Should or whatever it was? Wasn't it because they found like a piece of paper?
Spoilers!
In his pocket, and that's what was written on it, which was, and people were saying it was a spell, and others were saying it was like some protection thing.
Very well-known story. Obviously, most people know it, but I'll just quickly go through it because I was watching an ABC Australia documentary on it today that had all these twists and turns related to the investigation, because this has been ongoing. People have been obsessed with this case for decades, and
yeah, decades.
There's, you know, websites all around the world of people trying to figure out what happened, and investigators have been looking at it. So again, 1st of December, 1948, Somerton Park Beach, just south of Adelaide in South Australia. A bunch of jockeys are out training their horses. They find this man lying on the sand. He's lying on his back. He's resting against the sea wall. He looks like he's just sleeping. He's got his legs out in front of him. Maybe he's passed out drunk.
He was in a suit as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's in a suit. And people had seen him the night before and just thought exactly that. Oh, he's, you know, had too much to drink. It was first believed that he died in his sleep when police got on the scene.
Is that because there were no visible injuries with him?
No, he looked peaceful.
Mm.
And the police believe someone would come forward in the next 24 hours with a report of a missing person to identify him. All they found on the body was an unlit cigarette in his coat. He had like an unused rail ticket to a beach nearby. He had a bus ticket to the city. He had a comb from America, some Juicy Fruit gum, a box of cigarettes, matches, no ID, obviously. Witnesses did come forward, but they said they'd seen him at 7 p.m. the night before in that position and just thought, again, he was sleeping or he was drunk. Now, according to the pathologist, the guy looked British. They thought he was, obviously he's white European guy. They thought he was around 40 to 45 years old, and he was in top physical condition. He was very muscular, very fit. He had huge calves, this guy. And people said he obviously had a body of an athlete. Some people even suggested that he was a dancer, because ballet dancers develop very strong, you know, quads, and their calves get exceptionally developed. And he just had these massive calves. So the people were thinking maybe he's a dancer. Then it just got weirder from there. Nobody came forward. So police had no idea who this guy was. And then all these weird details started popping up. The first one was that all the labels on his clothes had been removed. They'd been torn off. When they did the autopsy on the guy, they discovered there was all this blood mixed in with the food in his stomach. His spleen was 3 times its normal size. His liver was almost destroyed. And it was obvious that he had been poisoned. Now, the problem was they couldn't find any trace of the poison in his system at all. And among the items,
so they could see the damage, but they couldn't find any tox screening.
They couldn't find anything. And among the items that they found in his pockets with everything else I mentioned, like you said, there was this rolled up tiny piece of paper with the words Tamam Shud printed on them. It wasn't written, it was printed. So the police put out a call for anyone who might know what these words mean and where they were from. One man eventually came forward and said that they were from the last page of a book called Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam.
Oh, yes. Mm.
And that Tamam Shud meant it is ended. So is this suggestive of suicide? He's got a note that says in another language, it is ended, and he winds up dead on the beach. Is it a suicide? But a few weeks later, another man comes forward with a copy of this book he claims was thrown into the backseat of his car, and he lives in the area. Now, in the back of the book, where the words Tamam Shud should be, it's been torn out. And the police, using microscopic testing, discover that this is the book that that piece of paper was torn out from. It's the precise book. There's all these versions of the story of how the book ended up in this guy's car. Some versions say that it wasn't in his car, it was just in this parking lot and he found it. He says his car was unlocked and it was in the back. Like, it's hard to know what exactly happened, but we know that that piece of paper that was found in his pocket did come from this copy of this book, Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. Now, this is where it gets super weird, because at the back of this book is this strange code. There's five lines of text in capital letters. The second line has been struck out. And all of this looks similar to some kind of encryption.
Mm, that's right. So that's now, where the spy idea came from.
Now there's the question of, okay, is this guy a spy? It's 1948, you know, the Cold War is just starting up. And what is going on? Now, at the back of this book with all this code in it, where this piece of paper's been torn out from, there's also a telephone number. Now, the police trace the number. It's traced to a nurse who lives 5 minutes from where the body was found. So obviously the police go and interview this woman. She's very, very evasive. She doesn't want to answer any questions. She doesn't know anything about a man. She doesn't want to go to the police station. She's not, I'm not cooperating. Something is up with this woman. In the meantime, the police create a plaster death mask of this mysterious man, and he's buried in a cemetery in Adelaide. They realize, look, we've got to bury him. So there's basically a bust of his entire body, his head, all his features, his hair.
Looking at it, because they've done recreations of how he would look.
Yeah, this perfect plaster cast. And the police bring in this nurse to view the plaster death mask, to basically see if she can ID him. Now, according to the people in the room that day, as soon as she sees this plaster death mask, she nearly faints. Like, she takes a deep breath. She's shocked. One of the guys I was watching in a documentary said he actually came and stood behind her because he thought this nurse was going to faint.
Does she recognize him?
She says no. She says, I don't know who this is.
How could you have such a reaction and not know him?
Exactly. Have you seen this man before? No. Can you help us? No. Any idea who he is? No. But moments before, she's nearly collapsed at the sight of this man. Now, the case goes unsolved. They can't figure out who he is, and it becomes this legend in an Australian mystery.
For decades?
For decades, yeah. It's since 1948. A few years ago, a detective named Jerry Feltus took up the case, because it's still an active case. It's an active murder case. Or is it a murder case? Well, he was poisoned, so yeah, it's a murder case. Could be a suicide. Strangely, the police didn't record the name of the nurse whose number was in that book. Like, it's not in any records. So this poor detective is coming around in, like, it was like 2010 or something. He's trying to crack the case. He doesn't even have the name of this woman. So what he does is, this Detective Feltus, he gets a 1948 phone book, and he's literally going through the phone book because he's got the phone number, because it's...
And he's trying to check the number.
And he's trying to match the phone number somewhere in this phone book so he can get the name.
Wow.
And he said in this documentary, he's like, I just did like 10, 30 pages a night for months. He just did it for months until finally, bam, he matches the name. It's Jessica, or she goes by Jo Thompson. This is the nurse that they brought in 1948, who claimed she'd never seen this man before, despite nearly fainting in the room. So he goes to speak to her. And obviously she's very elderly now. She's still very, very evasive.
Mm.
Doesn't want to talk about it. Doesn't want to help. Just not interested. Now, the detective knows something isn't right. But all he can say for sure, this Jerry Feltus, is that this woman must have known this man. Like, that's the only thing he can conclude.
Yeah.
But he can't solve it. Enter Professor Derek Abbott. This is a physicist and electronic engineer, professor at Adelaide University. He's just been privately intrigued by this case for years. He remembers going on a website, it's probably ours, and seeing the top five mysteries in Australia and seeing this case and just being absorbed by it. And he's just been using his particular skill set to try and solve it. So he's been using old hospital records and government records for years. He doesn't use the phone book. He starts getting all these old government records, and he tracks down through his own methods this nurse, Jo Thompson. But by the time this Professor Abbott figures out who she is, she's been dead for 2 years. So Professor Abbott is like, damn, what am I going to do? How are we going to solve this story? Okay, and he reasons, if this woman knew this mysterious man who wound up on that beach, maybe she told the story to someone close to her. So does she have a son? Does she have a daughter? Is there a family member who she could have told? Well, it turns out, yes, she had a son. His name was Robin Thompson. But by the time Professor Abbott discovers this, he learns that Robin Thompson died 2 months earlier.
Oh.
He's missed him by 2 months. But amazingly, get this, Robin Thompson was a ballet dancer. He danced with the Australian Ballet for several years. He had an incredible physique and massive calves.
Is he his son?
That's what he thought. It's like the physical features are kind of similar. Could this be the son of this mysterious man that wound up dead on the beach?
Could it be possible? I mean, it's very macabre and terrible, but was the nurse raped by this guy? And then that's why she had such a visceral reaction to him?
Well, let's not jump to conclusions. So Professor Abbott calls in the service of a colleague from Adelaide University, this anatomist. His name's Professor Henneberg. He concludes that it's very, very likely that this late ballet dancer, Robin Thompson, is the Somerton man's son. The ears match, like his earlobe joins, you know, the edge of his head. He's missing some incisors. Like there's something about his teeth that are very unique, which the son has as well.
Was there any DNA left? Was there any samples of the guy left anywhere? Because I don't know if
I'll
they
get
would've
to that. I'll get to that. He didn't need that at this stage. So the question now for Professor Abbott is, did this ballet dancer who's just recently passed away, did he have any children? Now, Professor Abbott tracks down this guy's daughter. Her name is Rachel Egan. And I'm like, Egan? Okay, maybe she married. She's got a different last name. But no, that's not why. Rachel Egan grew up in New Zealand. It's this Kiwi girl. She never knew her biological father because she was adopted. And guess what young Rachel Egan grew up obsessed with?
What?
Dancing.
Oh.
She's obsessed with dancing. She's obsessed with specifically ballet.
So it's like a weird nature versus nurture kind of thing. It's definitely nature there.
Yeah, there's something in the family DNA that precludes them to dancing, but it's more than that. It's something like it's interesting in documentaries I've seen with her. She said she grew up knowing she was adopted. She knew she was disconnected from her biological family, but she always had this thing where she just wanted to dress up in a tutu. She just begged her parents to let her learn classical dance. She wanted to learn ballet. It was just her entire life. And eventually she ended up tracking down her biological mother back in Australia. And she realized why she was obsessed with dancing. It's because her father was that dancer, Robin Thompson, who toured with the Australian Ballet. And her mother was a ballerina in New Zealand. And as the story goes, he was touring with the Australian Ballet to New Zealand. He knocked up this ballet dancer in New Zealand. And she didn't have the means to raise the child, she says. So she ended up giving the child up for adoption. And so that's why she grew up as Rachel Egan. And there's another weird twist to this. So Professor Abbott, who's trying to track down the identity of this guy, tracks down Rachel Egan. And he says, look, I'd like to meet up with you because I've got this crazy story. There's this murder mystery from Australia. I think he might be your grandfather. Is it possible we can meet and talk about it? So they go out to dinner and he checks out her features. Like, she's got that interconnecting earlobe and she's got the teeth thing going on. Maybe it's her. And then he asks her if he can have some of her DNA. And she agrees. And the next day, she asks him to marry her.
What?
Yeah. What? They get married, and they're now happily married with three children. So the guy who's been investigating this insane murder mystery for decades ends up marrying and having children with the possible granddaughter of the mystery man on the beach.
Oh, that's just... it's not so incestuous, but it's too close to home.
It's so weird. And there's this point in the documentary where they ask him, and I'll link to the full thing in the show notes so you can watch it. They ask him if he married her, or they say, well, some people say you married her for her DNA so you could crack the case. And he's like,
but she'd already said yes.
That's humorous. But it's like, come on, dude. It's weird. It's very
weird. Yeah.
But they're just like, well, we fell in love.
Whatever.
We had this connection. We fell in love. Yeah. And I guess there would be this family thing that she was perhaps missing that was somehow represented in this guy. You can break it down, the psychology of it.
But clearly, though, if he's asking for DNA, he must have a sample of the man, right?
Well, that's the thing. So he takes her DNA. What he discovered was that plaster death mask, they found it still had tiny strands of his hair in the plaster.
Oh, and it still had DNA on it.
Well, it took him years. So I was reading articles back from, gosh, it would have been maybe 2009, 2008, where he was starting to work on the DNA, but there wasn't enough. And the last documentary that I looked at was from 2017, and there wasn't enough DNA in the hair strands.
Well, normally, you need a follicle. Like, if you just have a strand of hair, it's not enough.
And that's basically where I left it, because that was the end of that documentary, was him going, well, we need to exhume the body and I need permission from the governor of South Australia and all this kind of rigmarole.
So the body was buried. It wasn't cremated or anything.
No, the body was buried.
Okay.
It's in a cemetery in Adelaide. But it turns out he didn't need to exhume the body because they ended up getting enough hair to get enough DNA. And this was the breaking news that came out on Saturday. I'll read this from a local ABC website on Colleen Fitzpatrick. She's this woman who's worked on numerous Jane and John Doe cases in the US. She first heard of the Somerton Man mystery in Australia in 2013. She met up with Professor Abbott in 2014, and together they've been working on cracking this case. They ID'd him. They ID'd the guy.
And who is he?
It's... 43-year-old was how old he was when he died. His name was Carl Webb. He went by Charles Webb. He was a Victorian engineer and instrument maker.
Oh. What was he doing on the beach?
He's not a Russian spy. He's not a CIA agent. He's just some guy from Victoria. This is meant to be the big reveal. I'll keep reading. Professor Abbott told ABC Radio Adelaide the team had been extracting DNA from the hairs since 2011, but by February this year, they had enough to start comparing it to online genealogy databases. So he basically explains that they got a hit, a very distant cousin in the US, and then they started from that cousin building out a family tree. And eventually, after a while, they had a list of like 4,000 people on it. And that's where this other woman came in. She basically helped boil it down to narrow it down to this guy, Charles Webb, through some relative on the paternal side.
Right, I see.
So in essence, they had this family with six siblings, and this guy was sticking out because he was the only one who didn't have a date of death.
Yes, yeah.
And they mashed him. This is the guy. But there's all these questions that aren't answered. Yes, we know who the guy is. We've got an ID for him. We've got a name.
But what was he doing?
How was he killed? Like, how was he? Was he killed? Did he commit suicide? What was he doing on the beach? Why has he got this weird mystery thing rolled up in his coat pocket? And why is the book it's from, why does it have all this code on it that the FBI could not decipher?
Well, I noticed that the ABC, because I was just looking it up, and it's describing that there's still speculation as to whether or not he was a Russian spy.
There's all this weirdness. So his clothes, right? This is 1948 Adelaide, right? All his clothes are from America. They're like American brands.
Yeah.
He's carrying an American comb. It's all that is immediately odd.
And let's not forget the strange sequence of letters. Like,
he's got a packet of cigarettes. He's got a box of cigarettes in his coat pocket. Now, often the thing that people would do back in these days is they would buy an expensive, nice packet of cigarettes. And when it ran out, they would fill it with cheap cigarettes.
Oh, okay.
So it's like you flip out the box and you look kind of classy because you've got a nice brand.
What happens in the Philippines, I've heard, where people get Starbucks. So you drink the Starbucks and they just fill it with water and you walk around with a Starbucks cup.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. Yeah, I saw this report where you want to look like you're walking around with Starbucks.
Well, they do that. They did that in the 1940s with cigarettes. But what they found was the opposite with this guy. He had a very cheap box of cigarettes, but inside was very expensive brand cigarettes. So it's almost like he was trying to appear to be working class. He was trying to seem to be something that he wasn't. And all of this kind of adds up, like the American comb. Today we hear that and go, so what?
So like, what?
Yeah. Half my stuff is from China or America.
It wasn't like big that deal. Back then.
Back then, having an item from overseas meant you bought it from there.
Yeah.
You traveled there and got it from there. You didn't get on Amazon and order it.
Yeah.
He's been to America. He's wearing American clothes. He's got an American comb. He's got this weird cigarette. And the fact that he had removed his tags, it's like everything about it, he's trying to conceal his identity.
Yeah, there's something going on here.
There's something super weird about it.
Yeah.
Again, no wallet on him. His shoes were unusually clean, considering he'd been walking on the beach. It's almost like someone had placed him there and he's got these brand new shoes. He's, even though it said he's this, engineer and
he's an electrical engineer.
He makes inventions and stuff. His hands and nails show no signs of labor. Like, he's not worked with tools. He hasn't really done anything.
Like grease or anything like that.
So it's very, very strange. The professor just says, look, it's just an average guy and it's just a conventional thing. Like, maybe he committed suicide. But that doesn't explain all the other things that are going on.
Well, it doesn't. It doesn't explain the codes. And if he was going to commit suicide, I know some people can just do it surprisingly, but normally you'll see that there's a pattern of depression or something going on. And now they know who he is, surely they could find maybe that information somehow. Right.
The case is still ongoing.
Oh, it must be.
So there's in all the articles about this, which I'll link to, there's always a statement from the police in Adelaide going, oh, that's great that we've got this ID, but
it doesn't reveal anything.
The case is still open. It's still an open case. There's no solution. We don't know what happened to the guy. We might know his name, but we don't know who he was truly or how he died. So it's still
a mystery.
One of the mysteries of Australia. So coming up in our Plus extension on that line of thinking, we're going to look into some more Australian mysteries. I've got this case of an explorer from 1832 who enters Australia from Raffles Bay in Northern Territory. And he starts heading south on this expedition with, I think, 9 other men. And he comes to this hill. He climbs this hill. And I wanted to play you some audio here before we go to our break of the famous bush tucker man, Les Hiddens, explaining what this guy saw. Let's take a listen.
We don't know what role Lieutenant Nixon played in the expedition, but we do know that one day he climbed a hill, which was later named Mount Singapore by the expedition. I suspect he was up there to get a reading of latitude and longitude using a sextant. But when he looked to the south, he made a remarkable discovery.
I'll just read you something from his journal here. May the 15th, 1832. On reaching the summit of the hill, no words can express the astonishment I felt at the magical change of scenery. After having travelled for so many days over nothing but barren hills and parching plains and having to dig for water every day. I saw below me a low and level country through which a broad sheet of water extended. Nixon claims that he saw small boats gliding through a maze of narrow channels and people fishing with nets. On the opposite shore, he could see a cluster of houses in a grove of trees.
That's incredible.
Who were these people? It's like going into the middle of the Gobi Desert and just coming across this oasis of people with technology, fishing with nets, with constructed houses and beautifully aligned gardens and boats. It's insane, this magical story. But Les Hiddens, the famous bush tucker man of Australia, who was very popular on Australian TV during our childhood.
Yeah, I've totally forgotten about him. And I was like, oh, he was a staple of my childhood.
He believes this story is true and he's locked in the identity of this lost tribe in the middle of Australia. That's coming up after the break for our Plus members. To get access, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. You get access to the big extensions we do every single Friday. And when you sign up for Plus, you also get a bunch of other stuff. You get exclusive shows that come out on Tuesdays. You're getting more than double the content when you sign up. You're getting a higher quality audio version of the show, a totally ad-free version of the show as well for our Plus members. And if you sign up for MU Max, the next tier up, you get access to every show we've put out. The entire back catalog is available for you. Check it all out at mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Sign up today. Help support your favorite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around. We'll be right back after this. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Welcome back to your Plus extension. Great to have you with us.